many would take the view that the reputation of the company is now in tatters. You wouldn't agree?
I think at the moment I would have to agree with you. We've had a fantastic track record of service delivery over many years in many countries, but clearly this is not a good position to be in. But we feel we've got to make every endeavour to deliver as well as we can on this contract.
Mr. Backhouse, it's a humiliating shambles, isn't it?
It's not where we'd want to be, that is certain.
It's a humiliating shambles for the company, yes or no?
I cannot disagree with you.
Ouch. That was the former G4S security boss, Nick Buckles, enduring a third-degree grilling by MPs from the Home Affairs Select Committee. Now, he was criticised over his failure to provide enough staff for the 2012 London Olympics, a mistake that would contribute to the company taking an £88 million loss. While Mr. Buckles walked away from the committee with a red face and a bruised reputation, although he probably got off rather lightly compared to some. So what should you say if you're questioned by hostile MPs, angry shareholders or managers interviewing you for a job? It's all in the preparation. Anticipate the questions, work out what to say, and above all, be clear about your goals. Well, international speaker and former journalist Michael Dodd knows all about the art of handling difficult questions. Having spent part of his career asking them, he's now written a book about them. It's called Great Answers to Tough Questions at Work. And I'm delighted to say that Michael now joins me in the studio. Very good afternoon to you.
Great to be here with you, Juliet.
Look, that was pretty toe-curling stuff. I can see your face wincing as well. But going before a parliamentary committee of MPs, it is a bit like walking on hot coals with cut feet. So he could be forgiven for those faux pas.
It's a pretty tough experience, and I've trained quite a few people who've been before such committees, and I know how nervous they get and how intimidated they sometimes feel. And, the advice that I give them is, you need to tell the committee what they need to know.
Well, he did, because he basically said, we're accepting responsibilities, we could have done better, in a roundabout sort of way.
Yeah, you probably need a bit more of an and. It's absolutely commendable if something's gone wrong to accept responsibility. That is demonstrating a responsible attitude, and whatever it is that's gone wrong, if you take a responsible attitude, that's a plus. The thing you need to do as well as that, which he didn't do brilliantly there, and if he had his life over again, he might reword, is once you've actually answered the really tough question, even if it's, why didn't you resign, you idiot, because you mucked this up completely.
Or this is a shambles.
Yeah, which wasn't in the form of a question, but he kind of got the point that it was sort of as a question. And the thing is that you deal with the answer, give them the answer, don't try and avoid it, which some people try to do at their peril. But then, under the normal rules of conversation, you are allowed to say something else that's helpful to your audience. And that's where people often fall down in front of a parliamentary committee and in other situations in the office, where they do answer the question honestly. They may take responsibility, but there is still an opportunity there to move on to the positive, to put it in a wider context, and even explain in more detail what you'll do better next time.
But the problem with these committees is that there is an element of grandstanding, isn't there? Because you've got these CEOs who are quite powerful people in the office, and all of a sudden they're before these MPs, and this is the chance for the MPs to stick the boot in, because they'll turn around and say, well, hang on a minute, this is what the public expects us to do, so we're really going to go for it, really let rip.
And they do. And some of them do it very well in the public interest. From the point of view of the person answering the questions, they need to take the approach that, sure, I will honestly deal with the questions, however tough and even nasty they may be. We have an expression in Australia where I'm from, blowtorch on the belly questions, and that's how it can feel. But you still need to remember that you're there to help the committee and help the wider audience. And therefore, once you have answered the question, you are allowed to add a bit more to actually help them to have a fuller understanding.
So if he'd actually turned the tables on them and said, look, I'm here, you didn't have to summon me, I came here because I wanted to set the record straight, and I'm trying to do that, and you're trying to score points off me, can you just back off one moment and just let me finish what I'm saying?
I wouldn't advise it quite like that, Juliet.
But along those lines.
Well, I think you don't want to be there saying back off I mean, as a journalist who's used to asking tough questions, and I'm sure parliamentarians on those committees feel exactly the same way, as soon as someone says that, you're kind of like a shark in the water smelling blood, and you think this person's defensive, there's really something to hide here, it's my duty to go for them. So I wouldn't take them on in that direct, challenging way, but the thing is that you're allowed to, you know, actually say more, present the bigger picture. And often in these sorts of situations where something has gone wrong, as it did for G4S when they didn't handle things on a big occasion particularly brilliantly, say what lessons you've learned and say what you'll do next time.
Mm.
That really helps a lot. And ideally, you know, part of this is actually painting a picture in the minds of the audience. And if you can actually paint a picture about what changes you've made so that next time, if you get a big contract, you'll do it so much better and people will feel and be so much safer, then you're kind of finding that win-win between you and the audience. So it's not a matter of just losing and collapsing in a quivering heap. You're actually there, you know, kicking a goal, scoring a try, for the benefit of your listeners.
Sure, so turning the tables really on the accuser. But in this case, with Nick Buckles, if you had to score him out of 10, and remember, he's got nothing to lose because this happened back in 2012, what would you give him on the strength of this performance?
I remember writing about his performance at the time, actually, so you picked a good one there, and I didn't suggest it. But, I think you'd be hard-pressed to give him more than 2 out of 10 there. But what I find is, you know, when you do train people, you get them focused on the positive. He probably gets the 2 for being a little bit honest. When you're training people, you can get quite a turnaround in them when they actually realise, look, I'm there to help the questioners, and I'm there to potentially turn the crisis of a tough question into an opportunity for both of us. And, yeah, he could have done that. He could have got 8 or 9 out of 10. And people do, I think, respect those in the spotlight even more when they are subjected to really tough questions like that. And so, therefore, if you do well in that kind of environment, you score, you know, even higher than 7 or 8 out of 10 in the public's mind.
Mm. And it's worth remembering as well that in some respects, going before a committee of MPs is no different to going before a panel of people who are going to interview you for a job or going before a group of shareholders. Now, OK, there may not necessarily be hostility, or there could be manufactured hostility to see how easily you get rattled. But either which way, whatever scenario it is that you're doing, it still comes back to preparation. So how do you prepare?
Well, you want to think of the positive points you want to get across. And you make the point about a job interview. And that was something that the publishers were very keen for me to focus on when I had the preliminary discussions with Wiley/Capstone, the publishers. They were very keen on making it broader than just advice for chief executives under pressure like poor old Steve Buckles. And so when you're going for a job interview, the same points still apply. You're allowed to say positive things once you've answered their question. And I think in job interviews in particular, it is a bit of a game, and you need to be aware they may be asking you things like, wouldn't we be better off getting a much better qualified person or a much better, more experienced person than you?
And that's deliberate.
Yeah, absolutely. They want to see what you like under pressure, and you need to realise that is part of the game. And your job is not to say, back off, as you mentioned earlier. You know, your job is to demonstrate. One of the secrets is show, not tell. So you show an experience where you perhaps did a fantastic job, and you paint that picture in their mind so that they can actually see in their own minds how you could be very useful to them. So don't take on the question in a kind of combative way, but deal with the question, realise it is part of a game, but make sure every time you get a tough question that you actually use it as an opportunity to get somewhere. One of my colleagues came up with this great line, don't play ping pong, which is just sort of hit it back. You know, are you incompetent? No, I'm not incompetent, full stop.
Mm.
That doesn't get you anywhere. He says, play rugby. You know, pick up the ball, run down the other end of the field and put the ball under the posts where you want it. And however tough the question is in a job interview, you've got the opportunity to do that. And the book, Great Answers to Tough Questions at Work, actually focuses on how to get into that right mentality and how to actually do it in practice.
Because you've got quite a few sporting analogies. You've got the football team, in this case, the football team with the players of 4-year-olds. There's also the Barbarians, the rugby team. I think there's also Gary Player, who's quoted as well, and quite a few more. But do you think that it's usually the most obvious question that are the toughest ones to answer? Because if somebody is interviewing you for a job, the obvious question they're going to say is, why do you think you're the best person for this role? And how do you answer that without sounding arrogant and over the top?
That's a really interesting, challenging question, and it's worth thinking about before you go to a job interview. You know, how would I respond to that? It is an obvious question, and I think you've got less excuse. If you fall apart in a job interview and it's a really obvious question, you really can go out and kick yourself because you should have thought out what to say in advance. And so the reason I use that football analogy you mentioned with the four-year-olds is that if you were coaching a bunch of four-year-olds and it was their first game of football, you want them to get into the mentality that they need to score a goal every time the ball comes to their team rather than just defend their goal and do nothing else. And it's the same with the job interview. So you think out in advance with that kind of question. And typically, if you're there, you think, I've got this tough question coming up at the job interview. What am I going to say to it? One of the keys to it, which is spelled out in the book, is to put in your mind what is the best thing you can say on the topic. So you deal with their question, whatever it is, and in the case of the one you mentioned, you wouldn't say, I'm the best person for the job, because you don't know that. You haven't seen the other people on the panel or who've come before the panel, so that would be arrogant. But you demonstrate, you know, by saying the best thing you can say after you've answered their question and painted the best example that's relevant to them after that, so then they are in a good position to say, this candidate is in a great position to help us, and let's get him, let's get her.
Sometimes the least obvious questions are also quite challenging. I'm going to throw in my own personal experience, because a few years ago I was offered a job which I accepted, and the opening question once we got past the preliminaries, hi, how are you, how far did you travel, was, quote, how much do you think you're worth? Which I hadn't seen coming, quite frankly. That was my interviewer, who turned out to be my boss.
Yeah, now, sounds like you got the job, so whatever you said can't have been too bad.
I have no idea what I said, because it was quite it was quite a while ago. But up until that point, I was simply used to people saying, why do you think you're the suitable person for the job? Not how much do you think you're worth? And, oh, you used to work for my father-in-law. And that was the other thing which was thrown in as well. What did you think of him? Which I refused to answer.
Right. So if you take the first one, I mean, that is an interesting question. If you look at it, that is a gift. You know, how much are you worth? That's your opportunity, Juliet, to show how valuable you are.
In which case, I undersold myself.
A lot of people do. And it may not be right to actually mention a specific figure. You might want to say, well, the time to do that is after you've actually, you know, you've decided that I'm the right person, and we can have a really interesting discussion around that. But, and then you show an example of something great that you can do for a company like the one that you're dealing with, and you give an example of how you helped another company in similar circumstances.
I tried all of that, and he basically said, look, how much do you think you're worth? I came up with a figure which he liked. When would you like to start? I'd never been through anything like that before in my life, or
right.
in a sense.
And was the figure discussed in the interview the actual figure that you started on?
Yes.
That is interesting. Yeah. I'm guessing I've got a colleague called Chris Merrington, who is a negotiation expert, and I'm guessing he would probably think that you probably left money on the table, that if you'd played it perhaps even more cunningly, your starting salary could have been even higher. So sometimes that's a case where you may not answer the question with a direct figure, and you might want to, in fact, you always want to, if you're not going to give a direct answer, explain why you can't. So, you know, you might want to give some reason as to why, off the top of your head, in that interview situation, it may not be smart for you to actually give a figure, but then you get back to demonstrating your great value and showing how you've been valuable to others. And then probably the really the right time for that conversation is afterwards, when they think, Juliet, we've got to have you.
Sure.
And they ring up afterwards, and that's when, you know, that's another conversation in a slightly less performance-orientated environment where, you know, you really can get perhaps an even higher figure than you got.
Sure, but you see, again, that was an extraordinary situation, because I personally had never been in a situation like that before, but it's back to front, because you're absolutely right. You normally talk money after you've been offered the job, not before it's been offered to you. So that was a rather curious situation. But, you know, the other thing which I noticed, and again, you've addressed it in the book, is that there are some people who don't do the preparation because they feel, you know what, we can just wing it. Is winging always a bad idea?
Practically always.
Because I know people who've winged their way through things and they get away with it.
Well, they may have natural talent. They may have a great case to put. The point that I would make is that, you know, however, when you hear someone make a brilliant speech in Parliament, for example, or, you know, perhaps even in the Brexit debate, you know, someone makes a great speech. And the question is, if it's a pre-prepared speech, did they just think about it on the spur of the moment at the time? And almost certainly they didn't. And so I would say, however clever you are, if you give some preparation as to what you need to say to hit the right spots for the audience, what is the right message for this occasion, and particularly what's the right example, then you're in a stronger position. So I would always give some thought in advance. You don't have to plan everything, and you don't want to sound like a pre-programmed robot. But if you take the simple thing about picking the right example, on the spur of the moment, I've seen people do this time and time again in training sessions. They think of an example and all of a sudden it's the wrong example. It might be how they helped the client and then they remember the client ended up going bankrupt or something. And they that sort of comes out along the way and they really pick the wrong example for the situation. And I make the point, however clever you are, you know, you're more likely to give a better answer and pick the right example if you just give it a little bit of thought. I mean, you know, I've had the chance of reporting on court cases in Australia and over here in Britain, and you know, you see a great QC, you know, give a speech to the jury, and they can be very eloquent and very impressive, but you know, they may seem very spontaneous, but you actually know they've actually given pretty careful thought to what they're saying, and that's why they're so powerfully persuasive. And it's the same when you're answering questions.
Is there a limit to how much preparation you can put into something? Because there's always the danger of over-preparing and then all your good plans just implode.
There is. And the danger of someone over-prepared is they sound too scripted. And if something does come up which is not what they're expecting, they're probably under more pressure, putting themselves under more pressure than they should. I mean, I have heard advice given in terms of giving presentations, but I think you know answers in tough situations are similar, where they say, practice your speech till you know it pretty well, but then kind of like rough it up a bit. Just sort of have a go, you know, when you're away from your notes and see how you go. And you don't want to sound too practiced. So there's a danger in that. But I think there's an even bigger danger of under-preparation and what I consider to be fear, not a fear of answering the questions, but fear of preparing for answering questions. And that's something where the people who wing it can find themselves unstuck because they just haven't done the obvious preparation and fall apart under pressure.
And they've only got themselves to blame. But, you know, the other thing about this book is that it tells people, look, it's not just about knowing how to fare in an interview situation in terms of addressing the tough questions, the obvious ones, etc. There's also an element of overlap, showing the people who you're appealing to, look, I share the same agenda as you. I want the company to do really, really well. And this is why you need to take me on board. But it's how you get them to see that, you know, you both have the same agenda, even though one is in the position to give the job and the other is fighting to get it.
That's very nicely put. In fact, if I'd spoken to you before the book, I would have put it exactly like that.
And I would have copyrighted the expression.
Yeah. I mean, one of the things, and you're right, the book, while it focuses on great answers to tough questions, as the name implies, it is helpful for communication in general. And one of the things, whether it's a pre-prepared presentation you're doing or whether it's a one-to-one conversation, you know, with the boss or with one of your colleagues who's worried about your performance or something, what you want to do is make sure you put the audience at the heart of your great answers or what you've got to say. So if you can imagine it, we have done a diagram in the book, but yeah, just imagine a circle. And that circle represents the agenda of your audience. So if it's a job interview, which we've dealt with earlier, you know, they have an agenda, which is to get the best person for the job for the good of the company and ideally probably for the good of themselves as well. Now, you have an agenda as well. So that's another circle. And if you were to draw it on a piece of paper, you would overlap it with the other circle because some of your interests are the same as some of their interests. And what you really want to focus on with your agenda, your message, your examples, is that overlap point on the two circles where there's a win-win for both of you. And if you focus there every time you're in trouble and you think that's where I need to get to, then you're probably going to do a much better job interview or a much better performance in whatever the situation is.
And it's also being true to yourself as well, showing people that you are comfortable with yourself. This is the real me. This is another reason why you should take me on, because you're not getting a concept. You're getting the real person, and it's the integrity that I'm going to bring to the job as well. So that's why you need to know about me.
That's essential. You have to be true to yourself. I make the point that you want to be the best version of yourself when you're on show in the job interview and when you turn up on the first day as well. But you need to be aware that if you are pretending to be someone else and you are lacking authenticity, that shows. And the kind of people we spoke about before, like journalists, like politicians on parliamentary committees, they will typically have a good sense of this person's for real, this person isn't. And so, again, as part of your preparation, you want to be making sure you're, you know, choosing the right stories to tell, which are often real-life examples that are actually true to you and demonstrate what you genuinely can do. If you pretend to be someone else, then you're probably looking for trouble and you're probably going to get even tougher questions than you may be able to handle.
I'm glad you used the word story, because one of the chapters in the book is about the power of storytelling. I actually liked the way that you introduced it, talking about going to Brazil, walking along the Copacabana beach, and there's this wonderful sense of building up to something. And then you said, when I went to the beach next door, boy, what a letdown.
Yeah. And so, you know, the point of that story is people like stories. People want stories. The best presenters, the best speech makers tell stories. I mean, Dr. Martin Luther King, you know, told a story about one day, effectively, in his vision, you know, that you know, young people will be judged, not on the colour of their skin, but on the content of their character. He presented a picture. It was a kind of a story for the future. And stories from the past can work, if they're well selected, really well. And, you know, they are stories. They effectively paint a picture in their mind. You want them to be true, but, you know, people have a desire for stories. And so when you're giving a great answer, it almost always incorporates a great story. That's what people really want. I think as human beings, there's something about, you know, sort of a narrative, just a story that appeals to us. You know, it's got a start, it's got a middle, it's got an end. It may be exciting, it may be romantic, it may be something else. But we love stories. And my point is to make sure you put those stories in your great answers, typically at the end, because if you're on, you know, in a tough situation and you end on an example, that's really powerful quite often. Mm. And instead of asking you another question about your, you know, alleged incompetence or whatever, they're more likely to say, oh, what you did in that example there, would you be able to do that for us?
Sure. And it stays in the mind, the power of the story, according to what the content of that tale is.
Absolutely. I have to say, I'll give a plug to one of my colleagues who I met many years ago, a guy called Michael Meach, who was a great storyteller. And he actually introduced this idea of building people up, that they were expecting a story and then not giving it to it. He used to finish up, instead of the beaches of Brazil, which I chose, he actually chose going to Barnsley. Now, I don't know why. Yeah, Barnsley. Now, I don't know why he picked Barnsley, but it didn't, with the greatest respect to the people of Barnsley, and I'm sure they're wonderful folk, it didn't quite have the sort of pulling power that it might have had. And so we actually did discuss this one. So I actually thought it was better to actually have somewhere really exotic and paint a really exotic picture, but again, not tell them the story deliberately, because just to make the point that people love stories and you should put them in your answers.
I mean, very briefly, I mean, this is wonderful advice that you're giving out, and it's that's in the book. But before you reach the stage where you are now, have you ever been failed by your own advice? Have you ever gone against the principle of it and thought, and having seen the outcome, right, this is why it should never happen?
I have. I mentioned that concept that the French have about the thoughts you have on the stairs on the way out of an interview. And I remember one particular interview for a broadcaster, actually, where I fell into a trap of answering the questions too keenly, too early, and not realising what their long-term game was. And I remember coming unstuck. But I was particularly focused as a journalist when I'm interviewing other people that some of them would do really well and some of them would do really badly. And I couldn't really work out what it was until I was shown, you know, what makes a great answer. And then I thought, people really ought to know this. People don't know it quite often and should know it. And it's my job to help them.
OK, Michael, we have to leave it there, but thank you so much for joining me. That was Michael Dodd, author of Great Answers to Tough Questions at Work. It's published by Capstone, Wiley Capstone, in fact, Wiley Capstone, and costs £12.99.